Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hello, this is Dr. Howard Gurr with another psychology podcast. Today, I'm going to be speaking to Dr. Ross Green, who is the originator of a model of psychosocial treatment for challenging kids called collaborative problem solving, or CPS. He's written two books on the subject called The Explosive Child and Lost at School. Dr. Green is an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's on the professional staff in the Department of Psychology at the Cambridge Health Alliance. He's an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Virginia Tech and a senior lecturer in the school psychology program in the Department of Education at Tufts University. Dr. Green is also the founder of a nonprofit organization called Lives in the Balance, which aims to provide advocacy and support for behaviorally challenging kids and their parents, teachers, and other caregivers, and to disseminate the CPS model through no-cost web-based programming. He consults extensively to general and special education schools, inpatient and residential facilities, and systems of juvenile detention, and lectures widely throughout the world. Now let's welcome Dr. Ross Green. Ross, thank you for being a guest on The Shrink Is In.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's an honor to have you. I've been following you and your treatment plans and, you know, reading your books on explosive kids, and the new thing now, obviously, for a while has been the collaborative problem-solving approach. I guess my first question would be, what was the driving force for you to come up with the collaborative problem-solving approach as a way of handling challenging behaviors?
Well, the answer is a pretty simple one. What I was doing before I originated collaborative problem-solving wasn't working very well for a lot of the kids and families and teachers with whom I was working, and that caused me to wonder if, at least for some of them, there might be a different way of going about doing things that might be more helpful.
I know in the CPS program, the collaborative problem-solving approach, that you have what you call Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. Can you tell me what the difference is between those plans?
First, a little background, maybe. The whole premise behind collaborative problem-solving is that challenging kids are challenging because they're lacking the skills not to be challenging, and that challenging kids exhibit their challenging behaviors in conditions or situations in which the skills they're lacking are being demanded by the environment. Those are some important things to sort of get out there right from the get-go, because, of course, the plans A, B, and C refer to three different ways of solving problems with kids. And I refer to the specific conditions or situations in which challenging kids are exhibiting challenging behavior as unsolved problems. And so it all sort of leads up to, how do adults want to go about solving problems with kids, given that in collaborative problem solving, I don't believe that these kids are poorly motivated and therefore don't need motivational procedures. They aren't manipulative. They aren't attention seeking. They aren't coercive, and they aren't testing limits, at least any more than any of us, any of the rest of us test limits. That's what sets the stage to consider how we want to go about solving problems with these kids. Plan A is when adults are solving a problem with a kid unilaterally, typically through imposition of adult will, and when that's not going so well, often subsequently with adult-imposed consequences attached. That's Plan A. It's probably the most common way in which adults solve problems with kids. There's some problems, of course, that go along with Plan A. Plan A, in the case of challenging kids, causes challenging behavior. And that's a big downside to Plan A, because the goal is not to cause challenging behavior. The plan is to reduce or eliminate challenging behavior. And what that says is that that form of problem solving, imposition of adult will, often with adult-imposed consequences attached, in the case of challenging kids, often makes things worse. Plan B, which is what I spend most of my waking moments helping people do and learn about, Plan B is when you're solving problems collaboratively. And I'm sure we will talk more about what Plan B involves, but Plan B is just another way to solve a problem, but instead of doing it unilaterally, you're doing it collaboratively. And then Plan C, the often misunderstood and underrated Plan C, I might say, Plan C is when you are dropping unsolved problems, at least for now, not as an act of giving in, because there's no giving in the collaborative problem-solving approach, but as an act of prioritizing. One of the things I have people who are living with or working with challenging kids do is we generate together a list of all of the unsolved problems that are reliably and predictably setting in motion challenging episodes with a given kid. The problem is those lists tend to be fairly long. Most challenging kids have 8, 10, 12 unsolved problems in their pile of unsolved problems. And we're not going to be able to solve all of those problems at once. We're only going to really be able to work on two or three at a time. In collaborative problem solving, the two or three that you're working on, those are Plan B. The rest are the ones you're not working on right now. That's Plan C. So really, Plan C is about prioritizing, not giving in. Those are the three plans. And as I've said, what I spend most of my waking hours doing is helping people not use Plan A anywhere nearly as much as they thought they needed to and start getting good at Plans B and C.
So, Russ, what would the elements of Plan B look like then?
Well, Plan B consists of three steps, or I prefer to talk about them these days as ingredients. I've always referred to them as the empathy step, the define the problem step, and the invitation step, but I'd rather talk about the ingredients of each step. The main ingredient of the empathy step isn't actually empathy. It's information gathering and understanding. This is where the adult is gathering information from the child so as to understand the child's concern or perspective on the unsolved problem that the adult is talking with the child about. That's the empathy step. Kids have legitimate concerns. And when we don't know what those concerns are, and when we don't make sure that those concerns are addressed, the unsolved problems remain unsolved. Second step is called the define the problem step, but the ingredient is this is where the adult is getting their concern or perspective entered into consideration on the same unsolved problem that they're talking with the kid about right now. Adults have important concerns as well. One of the difficulties for adults is that adults frequently leap right past their concerns and go straight to solutions. But adults have legitimate concerns, and if those concerns aren't understood and clarified and addressed, the unsolved problem will still remain unsolved. And then the third ingredient, the invitation, the better name for it probably would have been brainstorming, because this is where adult and child are brainstorming solutions that are aimed at addressing the concerns of both parties that they put a lot of energy into getting identified in those first two ingredients of Plan B. So that's what Plan B is on paper. For many people, it sounds pretty straightforward and pretty simple and pretty easy. The bad news is those three ingredients tend to be quite difficult for people and take a little bit of getting used to and take a lot of practice for people to get good at them. Once people are good at them, they tend to get over the hump.
You know, I know in your book you talk about two kinds of Plan B, a proactive Plan B and an emergency Plan B. And I guess my experience is that most people tend to probably rely too much on the emergency Plan B, at least in the environments that I work in. But clearly proactive would be a much better approach. Can you explain the difference?
Well, the difference is purely one of timing. I think of emergency Plan B occurs in the heat of the moment when an unsolved problem has set in motion a challenging episode yet again. I think of emergency B as predominantly a crisis management intervention. And here's my soundbite on crisis management. The more crisis management you do, the more crisis management you do. We don't really want to be doing crisis management. Here's the good news. a lot of what I've been helping people do these days, and a lot of the work I've been putting into the model these days, has been to help people organize the effort so that they are identifying a child's lagging skills proactively ahead of time. They are identifying unsolved problems proactively ahead of time. They are deciding what unsolved problems they're working on right now and what unsolved problems they're not working on right now proactively, and that's the whole prioritization piece. And I find that when I help people do all of those things proactively, challenging episodes become, number one, highly predictable, and number two, we set the stage for the effort to become almost exclusively proactive. When we leave people without a list of unsolved problems and without knowing which unsolved problems they're working on and which ones they're not working on, in other words, which unsolved problems we're going to use Plan B on right now and which ones we're going to put in Plan C for the time being, I find that we've left them hanging out there in terms of making quick moment-by-moment decisions about how they want to handle an unsolved problem, and it doesn't have to be that way. So the whole goal is for Plan B to be 99.9% proactive, made possible by the fact that challenging episodes do tend to be highly predictable, and that there are lots of things we can do proactively to help people use Plan B proactively. Proactive Plan B is a crisis prevention strategy. And when it comes to challenging kids as well as much any other kid, we really want to be in crisis prevention mode, not crisis management mode.
My experience is that, you know, teachers, school systems, even parents in therapy process always see behaviors as either, you know, an outgrowth of some family problems, some diagnosable disorder, or the child being manipulative. And you seem to be focusing more on lagging skills and unsolved problems. And it appears that social skills somehow are equated with, let's say, almost like a learning disability. Can you explain the lagging skills and unsolved problems so people understand the difference?
Absolutely. This is really the core of the model conceptually. I think if there's an enormous amount of research that's been done on challenging kids over the last 40 to 50 years. And I think that the most compelling finding in that entire body of research is that challenging kids are lacking crucial cognitive skills. And researchers, of course, have divided those skills into different categories. So we have research talking about executive skills and how they can set the stage for challenging behavior, language processing and communication skills, emotion regulation skills, cognitive flexibility skills, social skills. There's really rather impressive bodies of research on most of them telling us that kids who are lacking those skills are at significantly heightened risk for challenging behavior, and that perhaps the biggest difference between kids who are challenging and kids who are not behaviorally challenging is that the kids who are behaviorally challenging are lacking crucial skills, which has led me to the soundbite, why are challenging kids challenging? Because they're lacking the skills not to be challenging. If they had the skills to not be challenging, they wouldn't be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to something I said a little bit earlier, an unsolved problem is a specific situation or condition in which the demands being placed upon a child have outstripped that child's capacity to respond adaptively. That's what an unsolved problem is. So whether that's teeth brushing or homework or getting ready for school in the morning or getting ready for bed at night or extracting one's brain from the television set or video game to come in for dinner, or getting started on a particular assignment at school or finishing that assignment, or, you know, the list of unsolved problems is endless, but those are all unsolved problems. And when those situations set in motion challenging episodes, my assumption is that it's because something about that condition demanded skills from a kid that he was lacking the skills that would have permitted him to respond adaptively. So that's sort of the whole conceptual core of the model. All right. So now let's think about some of the other things that you mentioned that are often said about challenging kids. You started with family problems.
Mm-hmm.
Family problems is sort of your classic chicken and egg issue. Is it that the family's problems have created somehow this kid's challenging behavior, or is it that families that have a challenging kid have a lot more problems because they have a challenging kid. I mean, you and I both have experienced with people who we work with what a challenging kid can do to a marriage, what a challenging kid can do to a family, mm-hmm. what a challenging kid can do to a classroom. We got a chicken and egg issue there. I find that the families that I work with are really different from each other. They come from every socioeconomic status. Some of them are intact marriages. Some of them are not intact marriages. Some of them are good marriages. Some of them are not good marriages. Some of them are in good neighborhoods. Some of them not so good neighborhoods. I resist the temptation to point to the family as the cause of a kid's challenging behavior. The reverse could just as easily be true. Diagnosable disorders. Well, this is probably my most controversial stance because I find that, I personally don't think it's that controversial, but I find that when we focus on lagging skills and unsolved problems, we find that diagnoses as a mechanism for understanding why a kid is exhibiting challenging behavior and when, diagnoses actually don't provide us with very useful information. Diagnoses mostly tell us what a kid is looking like during his challenging episodes. So I don't find that a diagnosis gives me terribly useful information. Sometimes we pretend that diagnoses give us useful information. I sometimes, when I'm doing public speaking, use the following example. This is an example of pretending that a diagnosis gives us useful information. So here's a parent going to the doctor and saying, "Doctor, why is my child pitching fits, refusing to do as he's told, and defying adult rules and requests, doctor?" Well, because he has oppositional defiant disorder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How do you know he has oppositional defiant disorder? Doctor, because he's pitching fits, refusing to do as he's told, and defying adult rules and requests. But as I always say, one thing I've noticed about kids with oppositional defiant disorder, they don't always look like they have oppositional defiant disorder. When do they look like they have oppositional defiant disorder? When the demands being placed upon them have outstripped the skills they have to respond adaptively to those demands. All oppositional defiant disorder really tells you is what the kid looks like when he's looking bad. And I extend that, by the way, to many other diagnoses. There are some diagnoses that do give us some information about skills a child might be lacking, nonverbal learning disability being perhaps prominent among them. And other disorders on the autism spectrum give us a little bit of information about skills a child might be lacking, but also probably too much information about what the kid looks like when he's looking bad. So I guess that's my way of saying diagnoses don't give me the information that I'm looking for. Lagging skills and unsolved problems give me the information that I'm looking for. And I don't think what a kid looks like when he's looking bad explains much of anything about why and when he looks bad in the first place.
I wanted to go back to the CPS process for a second, and specifically the empathy stage. My experience in reading your book is that that's the toughest part, to kind of like get through the process without, you know, my own bias or thinking getting in the way. And you have a couple of identifiable pitfalls that you've come up with. So can you elucidate some of those pitfalls and how they kind of make the process go astray?
Well, yes, and you're absolutely right. I think that if we had to nominate one of the three ingredients for being hardest, the empathy step would be the place that, in my experience, people get stuck most often. The empathy step begins, just to give people who are may be not so familiar with it some background, the empathy step begins with a neutral observation and an initial inquiry. Usually the words, "I've noticed that," and then we are inserting into the sentence a highly specific unsolved problem that we are trying to talk with the kid about right now proactively. And then the initial inquiry. So it might sound like this. "I've noticed that homework's been a real struggle for us lately. What's up? I've noticed that hard for you to get out of bed in the morning and get ready for school. What's up? I've noticed that your room is really quite messy right now. What's up?" So these are, this is endless, but mm-hmm. Basically taking a very specific unsolved problem and inquiring about it. And then, as I always say, and so that part usually isn't so hard for people. Where people are most likely to get stuck there is if they aren't specific enough about the unsolved problem, in which case the kid doesn't know what they're talking about, in which case the kid says, I don't know, after we say, what's up? But if we're neutral, and if we're specific, and if we're proactive, then there's a decent chance that the kid is actually going to say something after we say, what's up? If he says something after we say, what's up, we've arrived at the hardest part of the empathy step, because whatever he said probably isn't specific enough to give us a real clear understanding of his concern or perspective on the unsolved problem, and that means we're going to have to probe a little, a process I call drilling for information. And drilling is far and away the hardest part of the empathy step for people. That being the case, I've, in the last year or so, begun being much more specific about strategies for drilling. And here's the five I've come up with. And here's the cool part. I've found that when people employ these strategies for drilling, they become much better drillers and the process goes much more smoothly. And this is sort of my personality. Whenever I see that there's something about the model that people are struggling with, I try to make it easier. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to make drilling easier. Here's the five strategies. Strategy number one is asking questions beginning with either who, what, where, or when. Another strategy, asking the child why the unsolved problem occurs under some conditions and not others. And here's what that one might sound like. I noticed that on the homework, you seem to be getting the math done pretty easily, but the science seems to be hard for you. Another strategy, breaking the problem down into its component parts. Writing has component parts. Reading has component parts. Getting ready for bed at night has component parts. Getting ready for school in the morning has component parts. Kids often don't think in component parts. So if we are talking about a rather global unsolved problem like getting out of bed in the morning and getting ready for school, some kids aren't actually going to be able to tell you what's hard for them. Breaking it down into its component parts for them might be helpful. And here's how that might sound. Well, there's different parts of getting ready for school in the morning. Let's think about those parts, and we can figure out which parts are hard for you. That's breaking it down into component parts. Another drilling strategy, asking the child what he or she is thinking in the midst of the unsolved problem. What were you thinking yesterday when you were having trouble doing the science homework? What were you thinking when I was asking you to come in for dinner while you were watching TV? And finally, strategy number five, asking clarifying questions like, how so? Or, I don't quite understand. Or, can you say more about that? Or, I'm confused. Just strategies aimed at helping the kid give you more information. And what I'm finding is that when people, as I've already said, employ any or many of those five strategies, they get much better at the drilling process. They get the information that they're looking for from the kid. And here's the reason the information gathering part is so important. As I've already said, we don't get a good handle on the kid's concern or perspective. And if we don't, in the invitation, make sure that his concerns are addressed, the problem will remain unsolved. And the whole goal in doing this is to get the problem solved.
I just want to remind the audience I'm talking to Dr. Ross Green, is the originator of the model of psychosocial treatment for challenging kids called collaborative problem solving. And this is Dr. Howard Gurr. I have another question for you, Ross. In terms of the typical response that schools give to negative behaviors, timeouts, suspensions, etc., we know that they're not helpful and, in fact, probably make things worse. How would CPS differ in its response to these kind of to challenging behaviors in a school environment?
Well, to begin with, first I should start off by saying many, many schools have become increasingly aware of the futility of their discipline programs. And so that's positive. The problem is in many places, a lot of folks still aren't exactly sure what to do instead, but, one of the biggest problems in schools is that the vast majority of intervention being applied to challenging behavior occurs either in the heat of the moment or immediately thereafter. That's a problem, because now we're in crisis management mode. Another problem, of course, is that a lot of the intervention, when it gets right down to it, tends to be punitive, and that's where detention, suspension, expulsion comes in. Collaborative problem solving is not punitive. Collaborative problem solving doesn't focus on motivation. It focuses on teaching lagging skills and solving unsolved problems. And collaborative problem solving is, in its best form, an almost exclusively proactive process. So how does that make life interesting in a school? Well, it requires a lot of communication that may not presently be in place. So when I'm working with schools, and I work with a lot of them, believe it or not, I find that helping people master Plan B, while that is very hard, isn't even the hardest part. Building in the organizational infrastructure to support collaborative problem solving is the hardest part, because those structures that would support collaborative problem solving often aren't in place, beginning with making sure that we are communicating well about the kids in our building who are behaviorally challenging and most badly need us to communicate well. Find that when we're not communicating well, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. We've left our staff to implement a form of intervention that I call winging it, which is where everybody's working on what they think they should be working on or what they think is most important to work on. Everybody's working on it in the way that they think they ought to be working on it. It's not cohesive. No one knows what the other person is doing. And one of the things that challenging kids prove to us is that when we intervene in that manner, it doesn't work. As I've always said, the only forms of intervention that do not require good communication are the ones that don't work. Mm-hmm. So often I'm having to build in mechanisms for communicating so as to make sure that we're not winging it, so as to make sure that the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, so as to make sure that we've got everybody in the building viewing challenging behaviors through the same lenses, lagging skills, and intervening in ways that are similar, making sure that we're prioritizing well, and making sure, first and foremost, that we are being proactive rather than reactive in the effort. So, quite frankly, collaborative problem solving is quite the horse of a different color in almost every respect compared to what in many buildings is being done now.
In your book, there's a vignette about a boy who is upset because he loses his recess time. In fact, I think his recess time was 10:15 in the morning, and there was some assembly coming up, and he was going to become upset when he realized that his recess time was going to be changed. And there was a proactive approach in which, I don't know if it was the building administrator or the psychologist, sat down with the boy and told the boy that, okay, there's going to be a change in recess. And when the boy realized that he was going to lose recess, he said, well, I'm going anyway. And I don't care that nobody else is going to be there, but I'm going to go. And the administrator said, well, you can't do that because there's nobody out there and you can't be supervised. And in that situation, the supervisor, the administrator, and the child worked out a solution in which the child's recess was going to be at a later time, which was very nice. But my experience has been, if I have a child who's going to lose, let's say, recess, hypothetically, because of some change, and I don't have an option. There's not an option for an alternative recess period. It's going to be one of those, it's this or this, and now I have a child who doesn't gain anything in their mind. I don't have a solution that's workable or collaborative because I don't have that flexibility. What would you do with a kid like that in a situation where I don't have an option that would be maybe amenable to the child?
Well, I find that, number one, when we're being proactive, we head a lot of that stuff off. But I also especially find that when – I don't think it's gain that is the primary selling point for the kid in participating in solving a problem collaboratively. I find that kids simply want to be informed and want to be a party to the solution. So, yes, I understand that in the adult's mind, we can't go out for recess when we have an assembly. But that's the adult's concern. It makes it feel like we have an either-or solution, and that makes us feel like, well, then isn't this really Plan A? No, adult concerns are frequently about things that aren't going to go the way we thought they were. And the interesting thing is, if we are limited to options that are simply, he's either going out or he's not going out, then it does make us feel like we've been painted into a corner. We really have no option. But if we say to the kid, proactively preferably, buddy, I just want you to know ahead of time, we have an assembly today at 10:15, and that's when we usually go out for recess, and I wanted to just hear what you're thinking about that. Now we have a chance to hear what the kid's concerns are, and we have a chance when we're hearing about the kid's concerns, that's where a lot of our wiggle room is. So we move it from an either-or situation or a, you know, he really just can't do that situation, to actually hearing what the kid is going to say. And a lot of times, these kids surprise us. They don't say, well, I'm going out anyways. A lot of times, and if they did say, I'm going out anyways, for me, that would just be a sign that the kid is having trouble wrapping his head around what we're telling him about proactively now, and is simply possibly proposing solutions that would only be satisfactory to him. Okay? That's not so unusual in the annals of collaborative problem solving to have a kid who is struggling with the problem we've presented with him with, or is struggling to come up with mutually satisfactory solutions. So if he said, well, I'm going out at 10:15, it would be tempting to say, well, you can't go out at 10:15, but we wouldn't say that. We'd say, tell me about you still going out at 10:15. Let's say he said, well, we always go out at 10:15. We continue drilling. See, this is the interesting thing. This is where collaborative problem solving can run aground for a lot of people, and this brings us back to drilling, because a lot of people would leave the empathy step and not get any further information just because, just when the kid says, we always go out at 10:15. I would continue drilling there. This is one of the most important things that I teach people about doing collaborative problem solving, is that we're not in a hurry to leave the empathy step. We really want to understand what's going on in the kid's head. So now let's say best case scenario, right? Let's say best case scenario, he says something like, well, I always play with Billy box ball at 10:15. It's what we always do. And, you know, this kid is sounding like an increasingly black and white thinker. Ah, so if we don't go out at 10:15, you're worried that you won't be able to play box ball with Billy? Right, we always play box ball. Now we've got wiggle room. Now we've actually got what this kid's concern is. Now, he might have many more than that. I personally still probably wouldn't leave the empathy step at that point. I'd probably say, are there any other reasons that it's important for you to go out at 10:15? I'd want to hear about it. There's where my wiggle room is. If I just run with, we always go out at 10:15, I really have no wiggle room. Then it's the adult's turn. That's what the define the problem step is for. Buddy, I just wanted you to know that Billy's not going to be out at recess at 10:15 either, because he's going to be at the assembly too. And that we're going to reschedule recess for later in the day. And just wanted you to know that I don't think it messes up box ball for the day for you. I think it just makes it later for you. And the adult can put whatever other can. Plus, if you go out for recess at 10:15, nobody's going to be out there. We're all going to be in the assembly, so there wouldn't be anybody to play with. Now we've got wiggle room, and now we don't have sort of this feeling like, well, but he really can't go out there, right? Well, at some level, it's true. He really can't go out there. But once we hear what his concerns are, we have the grist for the solution mill, because we know much more about why he's saying, I have to go out at 10:15. I hope that makes sense. It was a little long-winded.
No, I got it. I understand. I wanted that out there because I want people to understand and hear what typically happens kind of in school situations where, administration or teachers become somewhat inflexible. And, you know, they have an either-or kind of solution.
Well, I guess the important point is, I guess there's two important points. First of all, they probably didn't need to be anywhere nearly as either-or as they thought they did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that's a mentality, sometimes either-or is a mentality. Sometimes it's in our building, we say jump, you say how high. That's a mentality issue. if it's not a mentality issue, then it could be I hate to use this word, but I will anyways, a creativity and problem-solving issue, where the adults, and this is not uncommon, adults aren't feeling like they really have any wiggle room, because, to tell you the truth, they may not be familiar with the three ingredients of Plan B yet. But here's the other important point. If this kid is saying that he's going out for recess at 10:15, then I'm going to assume that this is not a random event. This is a predictable event. This is not a kid who is surprising us with I'm going out at 10:15. I'm going out at 10:15 because we always go out at 10:15. I'm going out at 10:15 is not the type of thing that would be uttered from the lips of a kid who's surprising you with that statement. It's a statement that would be uttered from the lips of a kid who is probably pretty inflexible to begin with, in which case we shouldn't be surprised that on this particular day he would have trouble with the fact that there's an assembly, which is why we'd want to be doing this proactively in the first place. A big problem that comes up in school buildings when we're not being proactive is that we find ourselves in the heat of the moment, and then in the heat of the moment, we are much more likely to head for what feel like either-or solutions because we feel like we don't have time for anything else. That's a huge part of this process, helping people anticipate difficulties before they come up so they don't find themselves in the heat of the moment and don't feel like they are stuck with either-or solutions.
Ross, unfortunately, we're out of time. So before we go, besides your books, I know you have a website that's very informative. Can you just tell the audience what that is?
I've created a nonprofit called Lives in the Balance that has literally days worth of programming on it to help people do collaborative problem solving. You could literally get on the website and spend days there. It's Lives in the Balance, Lives with a V, livesinthebalance.org. All the resources are free, and it's also the mechanism through which I advocate on behalf of behaviorally challenging kids and their parents and their teachers and other caregivers. When Lives in the Balance sees something going on out there that isn't good for challenging kids, Lives in the Balance takes action. So a great website for people wanting to learn more about the model and for people who are interested in advocating on behalf of these kids and their caregivers.
Ross, it's been an honor to have you on my little podcast show.
Thanks so much for having me on. This was fun.
Until next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.